Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and I'm pleased to welcome back two of my JP Morgan Asset Management colleagues to the podcast. Today, I'll be speaking with Jed Laskovitz, Global Head of Private Markets and Customized Solutions, and Anton Pill, Head of Global Alternative Investment Solutions. We had Jed and Anton on the podcast at the beginning of the year to discuss our 2026 alternative investment outlook. In that episode, we covered a variety of investment themes across asset classes. Today, we'll check in on some of those themes and how they're playing out so far in 2026, as well as discuss the top questions we're hearing from clients so far this year, from how the conflict in the Middle East is impacting private markets to what's going on in private credit. It's been a busy start to the year, so we've plenty to talk about. Jed, Anton, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Great to have you again.
It's great to be here.
Didn't know we had a choice.
So last time you came on, we talked about your backgrounds, your roles in JP Morgan. So we're not going to cover that again. But if viewers want to check out that last podcast, that was called What Trends Will Shape Alternatives in 2026. So recommend you check that out. But today I'd like to get right into the discussion. There's been a lot going on in alternatives over the last quarter since we last met. Jed, I thought we'd start with you and talk about the war in Iran, implications on private markets, and what have you been seeing?
Sure. And I think it's important to talk about both public and private markets when you think about the implications for investors. And I think the most important reminder is when there are geopolitical events like we're seeing in Iran and we've seen in different times before, is that as an investor, you don't overreact. Because just like we've seen with this conflict, U.S. equity markets are back to, I think, a higher point, at least in terms of when we're talking right now, in terms of where they were prior to the conflict. And I think the impacts of the war in Iran are like any period where investors need to reassess their current allocation, where they're deploying capital, where they have liquidity, and where they might want to think about deploying in the future. And, you know, back to the specifics about the Iran conflict, it feels like this will be inflationary. And, you know, we're still not out of a period kind of post-COVID where, you know, everyone feels like inflation is completely under control. And oil at $100 a barrel or more, or even less, what's set in and what can impact, you know, supply, you know, and demand is likely to be inflationary. And as we talk to institutional clients, they're thinking about what happens if we move into a period where we see inflation starting to rise again, and thinking about what asset classes and privates protect against a higher inflationary environment, like real estate, like real assets, like infrastructure, like transport, like assets that are kind of adjacent to those things, like net lease, where you might own real estate and use those cash flows as ways of generating, you know, generating yield. So again, like any time, it's reassessing risk, reassessing positioning, and thinking about what asset classes protect well. Anton and I like to debate the 60-40 all the time. While the 60-40 has had a absolute tear over the last decade in public markets, you know, our view, when you look at our long-term capital markets assumptions, is that, you know, returns from public markets are coming down. And pretty much every alternative asset class, whether you add it at differing degrees of an asset overall asset allocation, are helping to improve returns and lower risk. So finding diversification, inflation protection, and yield, particularly in an environment like we're seeing in Iran that's disrupting energy supply and supply chains, thinking about assets that are going to protect in an inflationary environment is most important.
Yeah, and we're seeing the same thing in the Market Insights team. Inflation has been the focus. That's a lot of investor conversations are around that, because that 60-40 kind of stocks and bonds protecting stocks when stocks downturn, that can kind of break apart when you have an inflationary environment and central banks aren't able to cut interest rates the way they would like because there's concern around inflation. So that's certainly something we're hearing from investors in terms of a concern and how they're constructing portfolios. So I want to shift to another area that's getting a lot of media attention, which is private credit. and particularly semi-liquid funds, individual investors, and how they're approaching that. What are your thoughts around semi-liquid funds in this environment?
Yeah, I don't think we can actually get up in the morning anymore without reading something about private credit. We have the entire media machine seems to have become a private credit expert overnight. But let's step back for a second and take a look at what's been happening in the private credit universe. And let's first begin, obviously, with the whole notion of a semi-liquid, these new evergreen-type vehicles where people are talking about the cap being hit on their 5% redemptions and some people not getting their full redemption requests being honored. And let's be really clear. A semi-liquid vehicle, at the end of the day, has limited liquidity. The underlying assets here are private assets. They don't trade regularly. And so by design, these products are set so that they have a cap on how much liquidity they would provide to people who are leaving their funds on a quarterly basis. And that is ultimately to protect predominantly the existing investors from a fire sale. Right. Just because a handful of people want to leave, you want to make sure you protect those existing investors from being a forced seller in an environment that may not be conducive to that.
Because the underlying investments are illiquid.
Yeah. I don't care what bow you put around an illiquid asset. It's still an illiquid asset, right? You don't wake up in the morning thinking, I'll sell my house this morning and I'll buy it back this evening and I'll make some money. That's how people should be thinking about a lot of private investing and private credit in particular. But there's a couple other things to look at. One, where's the money going? And if you look, the redemptions out of private credit that are being paid out, we are seeing an increase in subscriptions into similar vehicles in real assets, part of it due to sort of this inflationary question, but also into private equity, mm-hmm. also into real estate. And the private equity one is kind of curious. If people are moving from private credit into private equity to a riskier part of the capital stack of a corporation, by de facto, they can't be that worried about private credit or they wouldn't be moving to something that's even riskier. So I think a lot of this is indicative of people reallocating across their portfolios and getting the liquidity that they can to do that reallocation to get closer to neutral, I think, in their private credit piece. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it does kind of bring a couple other things to fore. One, you should be very aware of how your managers who are managing your evergreens are managing the liquidity in those portfolios. In private credit in particular, it's a little bit easier. You have interest payments coming off the underlying loans. You have repayments coming in. You can stop dividend payments out, and you have subscriptions. All of those things provide you the liquidity to pay out that 5% on that, or generally it's 5% on a quarterly basis. And so the concept of like a run on the bank here is a bit theoretical because the most you can get is 5. And so it might in theory take you 4 or 5 years to get all your money back. And sort of like that's why these products are designed that way. But stepping back, we haven't seen a big pickup in default rates in private credit. Maybe there's been a little bit of a flashing yellow light for some of the smaller companies that are not particularly profitable, but those have been flashing yellow now for some time. Yeah. But especially on the larger side, we haven't seen private credit defaults pick up or seen a material change in fundamental credit quality of assets. But as with everything, manager selection is absolutely key. You've got to choose the right managers who are really focused on the credit selection. And eventually, when a recession hits at some point, when credit spreads widen out, you'll see the real critical nature of manager selection.
Yeah, the downside focus. I mean, whether it's private or public credit, the downside focus.
It's the same for both credit.
It's the very same. So staying on another yielding asset class, Jed, let's talk about infrastructure. We've talked about a lot of movement into real assets. It's been a bit of a trend in quarter one. These hard assets that pay constant premiums have some inflation hedging characteristics. Last time we spoke, we talked about a few drivers of energy. So the energy transition, energy demand, energy security. Energy security has obviously been a big issue in quarter one. How are you looking at this as an opportunity right now? as a challenge right now? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, yeah, good question. And listen, I think this is something we're going to be talking about for a long time. This isn't a short-term phenomenon. What's going on, it's kind of driving the, you know, the three E's that you referenced, you know, increased energy demand, you know, the need for more energy security and independence, and then ultimately transitioning to cleaner sources of energy. You know, McKinsey's done some analysis on this. You know, they estimate that there's $100 trillion necessary to meet the increasing needs across those three, you know, dimensions, you know, grid modernization, funding the energy transition, and building kind of more resilient, you know, sources, you know, of energy. At the same time, you know, there's been a number of large capital raises and transactions done in the infrastructure space. And when you look out over the next decade, many of those, you know, funds will need exits in order to realize their return. So the opportunity to find interesting investment opportunities, you know, where there are funds in the future that will require, you know, more capital, companies that will require more capital to continue to invest into, you know, those trends is only accelerating. Listen, the demand story is talked about a lot. You know, clearly part of that is data centers. You know, just in the next 5 years, there's estimates that the need for, you know, energy for data centers will double. And this is a lot of energy. It's, you know, 50 gigawatts of power. 1 gigawatt could power a city like Boston or San Francisco. Right. So, you know, the story about demand is again, not just about data centers, because think about our lives and how electricity is now the main way that we provide heat and water in our homes. You know, security, you know, clearly we've seen disruption, you know, in the Strait with Iran, but, you know, there were issues with energy security and independence, you know, before this latest conflict, but this only underscores the need for, you know, countries to be more energy independent, which leads to renewables. Yeah. And, you know, whether that's, you know, wind, solar, you know, hydro, some of the transitional fuels like gas, you know, all of these things are going to be required to meet the increased energy needs that you know, both AI and kind of the electronification of the world, you know, will need. And the investment opportunities are significant, and they're deep. So these are markets that are, you know, large today and getting larger. Institutional allocations to infrastructure have doubled, and they're set to double again. You know, last year was a record fundraising year for the sector. And I think some of this is to kind of the last discussion we were having about credit. You know, private credit has grown massively in the last decade. When you see assets grow so significantly over a short period of time, you're going to see things settle a little bit. You're seeing that a little bit happen right now in private credit and direct lending. And I think a lot of that capital will flow to other asset classes offering diversification, resilience, and yield similar to the traits that investors were getting from credit and lending.
Yeah, and maybe staying on, I want to make sure we cover something that's been really topical recently on private credit, Anton, which is software and that kind of concern around tech investment in private credit. How do you view, like, software? Is it a risk in private credit?
Yeah, look, absolutely. AI disruption in software is very real. Even Jed and I were vibe coding on Monday.
Yeah.
And
what did you build?
I looked at a GRAT interface. I don't know what you worked on. Like
we built an app trying to predict the best performing ETFs in the future.
Okay.
So you can see where our heads are trying to figure out. But the speed by which you can prototype is just extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I think it is a truly evolving risk for private credit. It is 20-20, software is 20-25% of the private credit market. But like with everything in life, the disruption is a risk for some, but it could potentially also identify winners on the other side. And I'll give you an example, or some examples. I think lots of software is tightly embedded in things like accounting, banking, which will take many, many years to really kind of disrupt and take out. The moats associated with those companies is extraordinarily high.
It's not something that can be vibe-coded.
No, it won't be vibe-coded away by Jen and I on a Monday. Yeah. But there are also software companies who charge, do seat-based pricing, who use common data sets where things are coding heavy, which are definitely at risk. And I would say that especially private credit that was done in sort of the 2021 era, I think the coverage or 22 era, those are probably a little bit more, because a lot of that was done at multiples today that don't look particularly attractive, I think those are at risk. But like everything, it just shows that using a manager that can actually select the winners from the losers in the software space. Oh, by the way, and on a side note, any software company that can actually code faster than their competitors using AI tools has its own moat, because their margins might actually improve because they already have the clients, they have the know-how, they know what the clients are looking for, and to the extent that they can move even faster than their competitors because of AI tools, they may be the winner. So I think a lot of this boils back down to the selection of the actual companies is going to be the critical nature here. They're not all going to be losers, and they won't all disappear. But I do think investing in private credit today, it is very topical. I am not sure this is an issue within 3 to 6 months, but I think in the next 2 to 3 years, you will definitely get some shakeout and some refi risks exist for some of the weaker companies.
And for our public markets colleagues, I mean, you know, what you saw in this environment was a sell first and ask questions later. And, you know, for us as active managers, you know, that's a great opportunity for us because there's, you know, to Anton's point, there were a lot of companies that just traded off that will be fantastic companies in the next 5 years and are embracing AI and will develop faster and partner with, you know, many of the largest, you know, AI companies that are, you know, that are disrupting the market. So it's a very, it's nuanced and it's name by name.
Yeah, and institutions, by the way, are, even though some of the evergreens in private credit may be net sellers, institutions have already started getting involved and being net buyers. So you can see the clearing of these markets is already beginning as people are taking sides on how this plays out.
Staying on maybe that tech theme, we'll probably see some large IPOs this year. Last year was a good IPO year. This year is looking to be very strong. How do you look, Jed, across the both public and private markets, this sort of from early stage kind of venture capital through to the post-IPO public markets, investing in growth companies just broadly across public and private?
Yeah, and this is something Anton and I spend a lot of time on. You said it, it's a better M&A environment, but it's also a concentrated M&A environment because the larger transactions are really dominating, the year-on-year increases, although it's definitely improving. It'll be interesting to see how the second quarter unfolds, given, you know, it slowing down a bit around what's going on, you know, what's going on geopolitically. You know, the themes are there. I mean, companies are just massive in private markets. And yes, there are many of the large headline companies, but I don't think it's just about the SpaceX's and the OpenAI's and the Databricks of the world. You know, the reality is these companies are absolutely staying private for longer. And when you look at both the size and the number of private companies that are generating more than $100 million in revenue that are private, you know, you and I talked about this before, Aaron, you know, it's 90% of companies. So investors that are not taking advantage of that opportunity are missing a large part of the growth. Because also, if you look at the returns in the large indices like the S&P, so much of that return in the past 5 years or so has been concentrated in those high growth companies. So this idea that you can work with a manager like us to find some of the fastest growing companies on the private side in that growth equity stage, and also has an understanding about public markets, is something we're spending a lot of our time, you know, with clients on. I mean, we just co-led the Databricks, you know, Series L, which was a significant endeavor, you know, for us. And, you know, Series L, you didn't really talk about Series L's in the market
Far along the
very much, pretty far along. So, We think this is a space that will continue to grow as the number of public companies continues to shrink. I mean, there are fewer public companies, than there were 20 years ago by a wide margin. So, for private companies that have a deep pool of private capital to access, can have more flexibility, have the ability to operate as private companies for longer and still have access to that capital, they're not rushing, to go public. I mean, SpaceX has been private for over 20 years. So that's a dynamic that we think will continue and will present really unique investment opportunities.
Wrapping up with a question for both of you, what's an area of alternatives that you're keeping an eye on for the remainder of 2026? Start with you, Anton.
Yeah, look, one area I'm particularly excited about is defense and security. I think one of the things from the geopolitical realities of today is that there are sort of five components that I think are going to continue to require significant investments globally. The first is sort of the defense and autonomous nature of the growth of defense systems, et cetera. We see this from Iran, we see it mm-hmm. from the Ukraine situation, that space needs to continue to grow. The second is space technology. I think clearly the potential uses of space and how that's going to interact with in the future can change dramatically as the price of that falls. I think advanced manufacturing supply chain dynamics change significantly with some of the movements of and tariffs that are going around. Energy independence that Jed already mentioned, whether it's actually securing the critical resources to pull that off or actually building the energy dependence. And then lastly, let's not forget, as part of defense and security, AI and frontier technologies are also a defensive technology and are needed in a sort of a context of a global world that's potentially more unsettled. And so for me, in the next 9 to 12 months, we're going to be spending a lot of time trying to find how are there different investment opportunities around that can really tackle that theme.
Yes, for one area, but you managed to cram in quite a lot under that.
There's a lot, but it's really critical for all of us.
Yeah,
absolutely.
How about yourself, Jed?
Yeah, I think biotech has been a bit underappreciated and kind of sneakily, I think it was one of the best performing sectors in the S&P last year after a big run in the second half of last year. And deal volume in the space, if you back to the M&A discussion, is approaching record years. And it's not dominated by mega deals like the AI space. It's dominated by smaller deals, billion-dollar plus transactions, which I think is up over 2x, year on year. So you've got this big patent cliff. So, large healthcare companies that have drugs coming off patent, this cliff is happening in kind of 2020, 30, 31. So they're doing these deals now to prepare for that lost revenue, which is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And at the same time, they have a lot of liquidity to do deals. So this is a great environment for, private equity investors. And you have a government, with both the FDA that's been more supportive of faster drug approvals, and then back to AI, the promise of AI in healthcare and medicine is, higher efficacy rates and faster research times. So, somewhat levered to AI, plus what's happening in the overall sector, we think the outlook in the next 3 to 5 years for healthcare and biotech is really strong.
Very exciting space.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Well, thank you both for coming on Alternative Realities. It was a pleasure speaking with you again.
Great
thank
to be
you.
Back.
That was Jed Laskovitz, Global Head of Private Markets and Customized Solutions, and Anton Pill, Head of Global Alternative Investment Solutions at JP Morgan Asset Management. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our recently released second quarter 2026 Guide to Alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.